wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
This week on Dear Science, I was joined by AUT Professor Marcus Jones, where we talked about some of the Nobel Prize winners and the COVID vaccine's effectiveness against the Delta variant. Here we are now. So shall we start off with the first Nobel Prize in physiology and medicine?
Sure, yeah. So it's Nobel Prize week, and every day, well, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday this week, they will be announcing who won prizes. And on Monday, it was the turn of the Nobel Prize for Physiology and Medicine, or Medicine, and two people who worked on discoveries that explain how skin perceives heat and cold and pressure and may actually lead to drugs for pain were honored. And these people, David Julius and Adam Patapoutian, they made molecular discoveries that explain why things like chili peppers taste hot and mint tastes cool, along with revealing the proteins that help us sense, say, a gentle breeze or a sharp poke, the actual chemical pathways that are involved in those senses. And they shared the award for identifying the cell surface receptors that tell us how hot or cold something is and whether the skin is experiencing some sort of mechanical pressure. Now, this is not the first Nobel Prize awarded in this sort of particular field. In 1944, the Medicine Nobel was awarded for the discovery of nerve fibers that sense painful and non-painful touch sensations. But which molecules on these and other cells were key to touch and temperature perception has taken a long time, decades, to unravel. And their research really unlocked one of the secrets of nature by explaining the molecular basis for sensing things like temperature changes and mechanical force. So Julius, who conducted the research in San Francisco, was the first to discover a sensor in the skin's nerve endings that detects heat. And that's heat as in hot and cold thermodynamic heat, but also heat from chemical heat. So researchers knew that capsaicin, which is the compound that makes chili peppers hot, could activate nerves and cause pain. And this is the same mechanism that's used to sense actual heat. And in the 90s, Julius and his colleagues took a library of DNA sequences containing genes expressed in nerves sensitive to heat, pain, and touch. They expressed these DNA fragments one by one in cells that usually don't react to capsaicin, exposed the cells to the compound, and recorded whether they became sensitive to the pepper's heat. And this helped them identify a gene that codes for a particular protein called TRPV1, which reacts to capsaicin or heat by letting ions flow into the nerve cell. This is called an ion channel, which is a protein that lets charged atoms flow through. And the other laureate, Patapoutian, was the first to discover a gene that enables nerve cells to sense pressure. So the first guy got the heat, hot and cold, and the second guy got the pressure, and it was a similar mechanism that was involved in that one. And these discoveries could help develop, or people are trying to find pain relief or pain medications based on these discoveries. And the discoveries also have shown that the same molecules also help us sense the position our body is in, whether we are moving. They help to control blood pressure, breathing, bladder control, and things like that.
Wow, fascinating work. It really is.
Yes, it is. It is.
Let's talk about the physics one quickly, about this work on complex systems. Tell me about that.
Well, this is very brief because literally this has just been announced, so they haven't got a lot of detail in the explanation here. But these two researchers, so again, for the physics prize, three men won the prize, unfortunately, but they won the prize for their work on describing complex physical systems. And part of that prize, or about half of that prize, included foundational work that predicts the increasing levels of carbon dioxide in Earth's atmosphere and how it affects global temperatures. So three people, Theokuro Manabe, Klaus Hasselmann, and Giorgio Parisi. The first two, Manabe and Hasselmann, share half the 10 million prize, 10 million krona, Swedish krona prize, for modeling the physics of Earth's climate. Now, it's very difficult to predict long-term behavior of complex systems like the planet's climate, but computer models that can anticipate how it responds to emissions of greenhouse gases have been crucial for our understanding of global warming. Manabe, who is now 90, demonstrated how increased levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere could lead to increased temperatures at the surface of the Earth, which is pretty critical. And in the 60s, he led the development of physical models of the climate. And about a decade later, Hasselmann, who's now 89, created a computer model that linked together weather and climate. And his work answered the question of why climate models can be reliable despite weather being changeable and chaotic. And the other half of the prize went to Parisi, who's at Sapienza University in Rome. And he shared half the prize for his contributions to the theory of complex systems. And his work made it possible to understand and describe many different and apparently entirely random materials and phenomena. And this included the behavior of complex systems at the microscopic level. And his work has applications not only in physics, but also in other very different areas such as mathematics, biology, neuroscience, and machine learning, which is a part of artificial intelligence. These are two quite different prizes, but the Nobel Committee described a common theme that has to do with order and fluctuations giving rise to something that we can understand and predict. Due to these prizes, or due to some of this work, we can predict what is happening with the climate in the future, and if we know how to code the sort of chaotic weather systems.
Yeah, we'll look forward to reading more about that as it comes out. Let's move on finally to this very topical piece on the effectiveness of COVID vaccines against transmitting Delta.
Yes, so I wanted to talk about this because it just came out. It is this article has not yet been peer reviewed. It is undergoing peer review now, but it came out and it was reported on in the journal Nature. And this is very topical for us because we're starting to open up, and we're sort of bitten the bullet in New Zealand, and we've decided that we're not going to try and eliminate anymore, or the government has decided this. We're not going to try and eliminate COVID, and we are going to trust that everyone will get vaccinated and it's all going to be okay. But for the record, I think this is a gigantic mistake for the country, and it's a big shame. And this work maybe supports my view. So this work was about COVID vaccines and how they could cut the risk of transmitting the Delta variant. But unfortunately, they found it did. People who received the two COVID-19 jabs and later contract the Delta variant are less likely to infect their close contacts than are unvaccinated people with Delta, but not for long. So this is the first study to look directly at how well vaccines prevent the spread of the Delta variant of COVID. And there's some good news and not so good news. So the study shows that people who became infected with the Delta variant are less likely to pass the virus to their close contacts if they already have had a COVID-19 vaccine than if they haven't. So they're less likely to pass it on if they have a vaccine than if they haven't had a vaccine. But that protective effect is relatively small, so there's not a lot of difference. And it dwindles quite a lot at 3 months after the receipt of the second shot. Now, there's some people in New Zealand who have had two shots, and they've had two shots for 3 months or more now. So we know that the shots become less effective over time, but also it seems like the rate at which COVID is transmitted also increases over time. So previous studies have found that people with Delta COVID have roughly the same levels of viral genetic material in their noses, regardless of whether they've previously been vaccinated. And it suggests that vaccinated and unvaccinated people might be equally infectious. But studies also suggest that vaccinated people are less likely to spread the virus if they subsequently catch Delta. So their levels of nasal virus drop faster than do those of unvaccinated infected people. And their nasal swabs contain smaller amounts of infectious virus. Now, this latest study examined the effect of vaccines on transmission more directly, and it analyzed testing data from about 140,000 close contacts of about 100,000 people infected with SARS-CoV virus between January and August of this year in the UK, when the Alpha and the Delta variants were competing for dominance. Now, they took into account the type of strain, whether it was Alpha or Delta. And the authors found that although the vaccines did offer some protection against infection and onward transmission, Delta dampened that effect. So the effect was stronger for the Alpha variant, which really is no longer with us in New Zealand, but it's not, the protective effect was not so much with the Delta variant. A person who was fully vaccinated and then had a breakthrough Delta infection was almost twice as likely to pass on the virus as someone who was infected with Alpha. And that was on top of the higher risk of having a breakthrough infection caused by Delta than one caused by Alpha, because Delta, it seems to be more virulent. Unfortunately, the vaccine's beneficial effect on Delta transmission waned to almost negligible levels over time. So in people infected 2 weeks after receiving the vaccine, they did this using the AstraZeneca vaccine, but they also did it with the Pfizer vaccine. So I'll just give you the Pfizer results. So for people infected 2 weeks after receiving the Pfizer vaccine, the risk of spreading Delta was 42%, but increased to 58% with time compared to non-vaccinated people. So after about 3 months, you'd lost about 30 to 40% of the effectiveness in terms of how easily it was to spread Delta. These results probably or possibly explain why we've seen so much onward transmission of Delta despite widespread vaccination. But it does offer the intriguing possibility that if you do run a booster campaign, which has not yet been announced in New Zealand, but if you do run a booster campaign because you want to protect individuals, it might also have the effect of reducing transmission, at least in the short term. But the caveat to that is booster campaigns do raise new uncertainty, whether the same sort of waning protection from infectiousness will occur after a third dose. That's not yet been determined. So this study has not yet been peer-reviewed, but it has been reported on in the journal Nature.
Yeah, and it just gives us a lot of food for thought as we see how this plays out over the next few weeks or months.
That's right.
That was AUT Professor Marcus Jones on this week's Dear Science, talking with me about the Nobel Prizes and the COVID vaccine.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.